You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 250 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk Blue and Gold number 1, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow number 2, Superman and the Authority number 1, Superman Red and Blue number 5, Catwoman number 33, Justice League number 65, Nightwing number 82, Shazam number 1, The Flash number 772, Superman and Lois season 1 episode 13, Failsafe, The Flash season 7 episode 18, Heart of the Matter part 2, DC's Legends of Tomorrow season 6 episode 10, Bad Blood, and Sweet Tooth season 1 episode 3, Weird Deer Shit. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. Nick Cregan has been cast as a new series regular for the third season of Batwoman. Cregan will play Marquis Jet. It's either pronounced Marquis or Marcus, but it's spelled M-A-R-Q-U-I-S. A sexy playboy who grew up in a lavish lifestyle. He views life as one big joke, and that sense of recklessness has a tendency to clash horribly with his no-nonsense mother, Jada Jet.
I don't believe this is a character from the comics. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Drew, so we'll see what they do with it.
I've never heard of him before. I'm just glad to see Batwoman starting to move into a different direction, getting away from the Kate Kane stuff. So, you know, it looks like they're moving into a new direction. I'm happy about that. It's time to tell Ryan's story.
I agree. I'll be curious if this guy ends up being antagonistic. I have a hunch that that's what it'll be.
That's very possible. All right. For our next bit of DC news, DC Legends Tomorrow, Matt Ryan is to switch characters. Executive producer Phil Klemmer revealed that Ryan will be back as a series regular in Season 7 as a new character, Dr. Gwen Davies, an eccentric scientist from the early 20th century who might be the team's only hope next season.
Part of me wonders if they're doing something similar to what they did with Charlie, where they had the actress was playing Vixen, and then they changed her to play the shapeshifter. I wonder if that's what they're doing. I mean, I know they are literally having him change characters, but that was sort of like a way to get that actress an extra season on the show because they were done with the Vixen character. I wonder if that's what they're doing, where they're going to be done with Constantine this season, but they still want Matt Ryan, the actor. I don't know. I'll be kind of curious to see if that's the case.
Yeah, it's going to be weird him playing a different character, too. Honestly.
He's just so good at Constantine, and I mean, he's done it obviously on these shows, on his own show. He's done the animated Constantine stuff. Like, he's really made himself pretty ingrained into the character, so it's going to be weird seeing him as somebody else on the same show.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see this new character's personality. So, all right, and for a last bit of DC news, we also have Amy Louise Pemberton, who plays Gideon. She's going to play a human Gideon full-time season 7, which I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah, I know they've kind of flirted with doing that a couple times in some of the earlier seasons. I've never really cared too much for it. I mean, I don't really dislike it necessarily, but I don't know. I don't necessarily have, I've not been eager to get a human version of Gideon, so.
Now I wonder, whatever. If they're going to have a human version of Gideon, are they going to do away with Gideon being the computer system? Is the computer system going to change? I'm just curious.
I think it's going to be pretty similar to what we've seen in past seasons where, you know, like there was the episode where she like manifested herself in Zari's loop, time loop that she was in. I don't know. I feel like it's going to be something similar to that where she is the AI and she's just like manifests herself physically.
Yeah, maybe they find some sort of technology that allows that too. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, from a plot, but from a TV show perspective, I get what they're doing because they've got, we know Rory's leaving the show. So they've got an open cast member. So it makes sense to slot somebody else in, and maybe they don't want to just add one new person every year. Maybe they want to add, like, in order to like mix it up, because otherwise we would have had just a couple seasons in a row where they add like one singular new person and everybody else stays. This one would make sense in that like they're adding somebody, but it's not a completely new. They don't have to start from scratch again.
Yeah, and you never know, they may be planning on this next season being their last too. We don't know.
I feel like Legends always has to sort of kind of proceed as if it might be their last season because they're always, I feel like, on the knife's edge of whether they get picked up or not. So it wouldn't shock me.
All right. Well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Welcome to the Ring of Thunder, the most electrifying wrestling podcast in the Thunderverse and the ESO Network. From the power of the people's host, Sexy Thor, critics say, it doesn't matter what the critics say. You already know you're in for a hammer-swinging, burrito-eating, mic-blazing, hair-raising time with this weekly wrestling adventure, WWE, AEW, Impact, and whatever else I can possibly fit. If you hear what the Thunder is talking.
And we're back, but before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you.
For you.
All right, let's talk Blue and Gold number one. The issue starts off in New York City. Booster Gold is streaming on InstaSlam Live while he battles against an alien ship that has the Justice League captured inside. Across town, Ted Kord is talking to his father at his tombstone. Ted screwed something up, but they don't directly tell us what it is. Well, they want us to read Suicide Squad Bad, but it seems that it has something to do with Kord Industries. Now, Skeets gets Ted because Booster needs his help. Skeets determines that the android movements are determined by an array of embedded sensors. Ted floods it with so much conflicting data that it spirals out of control from information overload. The alien ship fires on Ted's Beetle. Both Booster and Ted jump out onto the hull of the alien ship at the last second. Booster and Beetle travel through the ship until they find the Justice League. And Booster fights against the alien tech while Ted makes his way into a maintenance tunnel and deactivates the cell that is holding the Justice League. Now the Justice League escapes and everyone gets to safety. Black Adam recruits Booster with helping clean up debris, and the League asks Ted to join the League. But they don't want Booster. Ted says no Booster, no Beetle. So Ted and Michael decide to start their own team. One that handles things Superman, Batman, and the others don't have time for or can't. Now, light years away, Omnizon returns without the captives. She is commissioned to kill those that interfered. That's Booster and Blue Beetle.
So I want to start with, I'm super thrilled that we have a Booster Gold and Blue Beetle series. That's awesome. Especially the two of them teaming up together. I feel like it's been a while. since we've had that, just Ted's been dead for so long. It didn't necessarily take away from my enjoyment of the book, but I don't know about you, Drew. I felt occasionally like Juergens was trying too hard to be modern / relevant with the like live feed thing. The live feed felt like something Booster would do, but it felt like some of the, I don't know. Sometimes it felt like it was like, Juergens, you're not a young man anymore, my guy. I don't know. I'm not either, but
it didn't bother me that much because if you put Boost, you know, the Booster we had back then, there was no Insta Slam Live back when, you know, when Booster was created and stuff. So it makes totally sense to me for him to be on a streaming service, yeah, streaming stuff to, you know, Booster his image.
I agree with you, Drew. It's not, that makes complete sense. I thought that was a really good choice by Juergens. I just thought his attempt at writing the online chat dialogue was the part that was out of touch.
Okay, that could very well be. I have to tell you one thing. I read through all the online chat things, but I didn't really care for that part of the story, honestly. I much rather just focused on the story itself, not the comments. They were kind of distracting.
Yeah, and that, like I said, it's a nitpick because it really didn't take away from the story for me that much. Yeah, like I noticed it, and it, like you said, it got distracting occasionally just because there was so much. There was too many of them to just ignore them. You kind of had to read them, but they also really, I didn't think, contribute almost anything to the story. So, I don't know. That part, I get, if you're going to have him be on, you know, Instagram Live or some other streaming thing, I get that you want to show comments and stuff like that, but I don't know, maybe there's a different way to do it. Other than that, I liked it. I liked Ted getting approached by the Justice League and them not wanting Booster. That felt pretty accurate. So, like, I'm curious to see where the series goes. Yeah, I mean, it's Juergens, who's the creator of Booster Gold, so you're going to get, in theory, the most authentic Booster, but I do feel like other people have also written Booster better, arguably, sometimes. That might be blasphemous, but I do feel that.
I have to agree with you. I like Keith Giffen's version of Booster Gold, so... All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, number 2. Ruthie is annoyed by the smell of the passenger next to her. She politely asks the alien to give her space she paid for, or Supergirl will rough him up. An alien comes up to Supergirl wanting revenge because Superman put two of his brothers in the Phantom Zone. Supergirl knocks him on the ground, then steps on his shooting arm as she leaves. The ship's pilot calls on Supergirl to help take care of a Carpane dragon. Powerless, Supergirl finds a passenger with Reds she can take. Reds is red kryptonite encased in dissolvable lead. When most people take it, they get weird visions about transforming into things. When Kryptonians take it, the visions come true. Supergirl gets wings and is powered up, and she drives the dragon away. Ruthie gets taught by Supergirl how to wash your hands after using the restroom. Always something important, especially with COVID.
Just any time.
The alien gets in Ruthie's space again, and Supergirl punches him. In a flashback sequence, we learn that Supergirl carries both Ruthie and Crypto to a boat, rows them down a river, and then finds a talented mender. The mender was able to heal both Ruthie and Supergirl, but Crypto passed on. And we see at the end of the issue, Supergirl agrees to help Ruthie track down her father's killer.
I enjoyed this issue yet again. I remain very intrigued by where King is going to steer the story. The only thing that was, I was surprised at his decision, I don't necessarily dislike it, but I was surprised that he did it, was that he threw the sort of reason why Supergirl decided to bring this girl with her ultimately at the end of the issue instead of at the beginning. again, I don't necessarily dislike the choice, but it was surprising that we sort of, you know, went through what was relatively the next part of the story and then backtracked and like, oh, by the way, this is how they ended up on the ship. I was like, oh, okay. A little bit surprised you did it that way, but it works.
Now, you didn't mention what the reason was. It's because he killed Crypto, obviously.
Well,
what's your reasoning?
My interpretation, Drew, is that Crypto was... that she was bringing the girl along because there was still a chance to save Crypto. They needed to figure out how to get the poison. And to do that, Supergirl needed to track the guy down. So that was her reason for going after the guy.
Oh, okay. I totally missed that. I thought she wanted to get back at the guy for killing Crypto.
Well, I imagine we know from the first issue that she ends up killing the guy. So it wouldn't shock me if that's where we end up. And maybe I misinterpreted, but my interpretation of the events was neither. So at the end of the first issue, she is, you know, shot up by arrows, as is Crypto. But she survives and drags both her and both herself, Crypto, and the girl all the way to town. And the three of them are able to recover, except for Crypto, because there was poison in the arrows. And they say that the dog could be saved if they could, you know, if they knew the poison and could therefore make an antidote. But because that guy is, you know, out in space, gone, that's not going to be possible. So Crypto will die given those circumstances. So what it my interpretation was is that Supergirl is essentially throwing a Hail Mary to find the guy in time to get the antidote, you know, and save Crypto.
Killing Crypto is kind of dark, but it does give Supergirl motivation to go after this guy.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, and that's something we've seen before from King. Is he does make the dark decision sometimes, this decision that you wouldn't necessarily see, which I can see some people not liking because they don't want to see that. They just want their heroes to be happy. But, and I get that. I do get that. But I also like that he makes risky decisions, because one of the things I love about King's comics, he's not the only one that does that, but I don't know where the story is going to go, because I know that he's not always going to just pick the safe option. You know what I mean? And we talk about this with some of the CW shows too. We know inherently that characters are safe, or that nothing really is going to go wrong, because they never go wrong. And one of the things I like in his comics is sometimes they do actually go wrong.
Yeah, and it's always... I like that, because it gives us a different perspective or a different way the story can go than what we're used to, instead of getting, you know, kind of the same story again.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So we'll see. I my interpretation, Drew, is that Crypto is not dead currently. My anticipation is that he will die, but we'll see.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Superman and the Authority number one. In Washington, D.C., November 1963, John F. Kennedy tells Superman about his world of tomorrow. Superman promises John F. Kennedy that he will make this a better world. South London, United Kingdom. Manchester Black is surrounded. He comes out using his powers, but one of them gets a lucky shot. Manchester Black goes down. Superman shows up and takes over. At the Fortress of Solitude, Superman has nanites fixing up Manchester Black. Superman states he needs his help, and he's putting together a team. There's a Phantom Zone breach, and robots try to kill Superman, but Manchester Black uses his telekinesis to stop the escape. Superman shows Manchester Black King Arthur's Round Table, and Superman wants to succeed where he failed with the Justice League. In Earth's orbit, there is a secret meeting where villains gather. One of them in the shadow states that finally the time has come where Superman grows weak and he grows stronger. Now his oldest enemy is exactly where he wants him, and he knows the truth about Kryptonite and how to really destroy him. That last scene I just described, that has me really intrigued who that is and how they plan on killing Superman. It's really interesting. Plus, we're kind of seeing Manchester Black as a double agent here, which I found interesting too.
I like this issue quite a bit, Drew. And when I mean, I was excited for this because I really enjoy the way Grant Morrison writes Superman. I just feel like he characterizes him so well and just gets like the core essence of what I feel like most people want when they read a Superman comic. Obviously not everybody, but he just gets that like the super part. And I always feel like Superman is at his best as a character when Grant is writing him. So, and that continued in this issue. We're seeing a less powered Superman, right? Like he's losing his step, but he's still doing all the things you expect Superman to do. He already knows that an attack is coming from the Phantom Zone and is prepared in advance for it. Going to fight it even though he at this point can't handle that on his own. I mean, all of that was just, that felt so true to Superman to me. And that's something I feel like Grant just does so well, so consistently.
Yeah, I thought this was a pretty good issue also. So I'm curious to see where the story is going to go from here. That's another thing with this title. When I was reading through it, I'm like, I have no idea where the story's going. So,
yeah,
it's always good to get stories where we don't know where it's going.
I agree. Yeah, like I truly have no. I mean, I assume we're going to get a conflict between the mystery villain and Superman at some point. But other than that, I have no idea, and we don't know who that is. We don't know, like you said, we don't know what their plan is. We don't know if that will factor in right away or if that'll come in towards the end. I don't know. It's good stuff.
Sure is. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Superman Red and Blue number 5. The first story was called Fetch, written by Judd Winnick and illustrated by Ibrahim Mustafa. Clark is feeling depressed and Paul Kent is worried about him. A crash from the sky gets Clark's attention and rushes to find out what it is. Another spacecraft from Krypton has a dog inside. While Clark's playing with the dog, Ma and Paul Kent learn this was a test flight with a live subject trying to perfect Kal-El's space pod. I really liked that story a lot.
I did. I did too. I mean, I liked it from you getting, you know, from the perspective of Clark's parents and him needing somebody to connect to as a powered being as a kid. And then just also getting a different take on the crypto backstory was cool. I very much enjoyed that story.
I did too. All right, the next story is called De-Escalation, written by G. Willow Wilson and illustrated by Valentine DeLeandro. Clark is going into a convenience store he frequents and almost knocks over the comic book rack, something that happens often. He knows the owners and says hi to the daughter Lisa, who's studying for a final. A kid in a mask tries to rob the store, and Clark is able to talk him down. I gotta tell you, I think it was on purpose. This Clark reminded me an awful lot of Christopher Reeve version of Clark Kent, and they kind of even drew him to look like him. I really enjoyed this story also.
Yeah, Drew, I agree with you completely, and that was something I noticed too. That was awesome, and I thought it worked well for this story too, where they wanted to highlight Clark Kent, like, you know, the human side of him. He saves the day purely as Clark. I mean, yes, technically he's able to take some chances because he's Superman, but ultimately Clark's the one that saves the day in that story. And like you said, the touch with him being essentially Christopher Reeves was awesome. It was a great story. And again, I know Wilson has her own stuff that she does. And to be honest with you, I don't know if she still writes for Marvel or not, but she certainly did not too long ago. I wish DC would give her more work if she wanted it, because she's such a good writer.
Yeah, I agree with you there. All right, our next story is called Your Favorite, written by Joshua Williamson and illustrated by Chris Sprouse and Carl Story. Jimmy Olsen is getting interviewed, and he's asked which picture of Superman that he's taken is his favorite. We find out that his favorite is one where he left the cap on his lens. But then Jimmy accidentally takes a selfie of him and Superman.
This was another nice story. I felt like a lot of these were really feel-good stories in particular. I felt like, I don't know if that was an intentional theme, but a lot of these I thought really were, not that Superman stories aren't normally feel-good, but this one felt like in particular this issue as a whole were really kind of wholesome stories.
I have to agree with you on that, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not complaining. And if you're going to do it, I mean, Superman, that's kind of one of the characters to do it for, too. So it definitely worked.
All right, our next story is called Red Sun, Blue Dot, written and illustrated by Mark Buckingham. Jor-El and Laura discuss baby Kal-El's journey and possible future. I got to tell you, on this story, Cletus, I love the color scheme in the story. Because you had Kal-El's spacecraft in red and blue, while the background was in black and white. And the dialogue boxes were blue for Jor-El and red for Laura. And then the comic strip itself was framed with flying Supermen that were blue with a red background. And then, like, on the bottom was, like, red with a blue background. It looked pretty awesome.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I thought the art was really well done. And like you said, the way they were able to frame the story. The only thing I would have liked, I think would have improved this, it didn't really take, I thought, any new path story-wise or took any chances. It was, I mean, the most standard possible telling of Clark leaving Krypton. And so I was like, ah, man, because like I said, like you, I enjoyed the art. I was like, this could be a lot better, but you kind of like, you just told the same story again. I wish they would have done something new with all this stuff that they had going on.
Yeah, I have to agree. It wasn't a new story, but we don't usually see the story from Jor-El and Laura's perspective though. So I thought that was kind of new, but there was nothing new about the story. That's for sure.
Yeah. Like I said, it was not bad. It was well-written. The art was really well done. I just wish it had done something, at least one thing, I think, a little bit different. Because you're right, we don't normally get it from their perspective, but we have. It just, again, it did not make the story bad, but I think it, to me, this was the one I enjoyed the least. Not, again, not because it's a bad story, but just because it didn't really do anything new for me. It was just, you know, Clark's origin again.
All right, and our last story was called Generations, written and illustrated by Daniel Warren Johnson. Jonathan goes to his priest because he's worried about being a good father. The father tells him a story from the Bible and then tells Jonathan, make sure your boy knows how you feel about him and the rest will fall in place. We see Jonathan tell Clark he loves him, he's proud of him, he's special, different times over the years. And then after Jonathan is gone, we see that this carries over to Superman as he tells people around him they are special, he loves them, and I'm proud of you.
Drew, this one was so good. I don't know about you, but like this one really, like this, I loved the theme of this one. And I know the dialogue is really simple, but it just hits so hard. Man, I big fan of this story.
I know, and I thought the placement of it was good too, to end the issue with this story. Because it's such a feel-good story, and it morally told a good story. You know, you want to spread love, show love. It was just awesome.
It's really good. I've been very, very impressed and pleased with the Superman Red and Blue series as a whole. But man, if you're only going to get one issue, I think it might need to be this issue. This just was overall, all of them were good. I don't really think there were any misses in this issue. And this, man, Drew, this final story, I'm a huge fan of it. It just hit the sweet spot for me as a good comic, but as a Superman story, good stuff.
Sure was. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Catwoman number 33, Alleytown, Gotham, is in its third consecutive day of protest. St. Thomas Church continues to burn, with fire spreading to nearby buildings. The police have not ascertained how the blaze was started, but protesters are being blamed. 2 hours ago, Mayor Nakano sanctioned the use of magistrate personnel to counteract the violence and apprehend the leaders stoking the fires of discontent. Catwoman returns from visiting Leo in the hospital, and the Strays have moved their headquarters from the Nest to a new location, away from Maggie, Selina's sister. Catwoman finds out that Edward Nygma has been helping them. Not only the Riddler, but also Basil Carlo, Clayface, along with Killer Croc, Knockout, Firefly, and Cheshire. At the Alleytown GCPD precinct, we see that Detective Hadley discovers that Carl Valley has been hired by Penguin to take out Catwoman, and Hadley goes to warn her. Killer Croc, Clayface, and Catwoman all go to meet with Rollins. They want to smuggle people out of Alleytown. And when they leave the meeting, Father Valley strikes with an explosive. Father Valley and Catwoman fight, and Father Valley stabs Catwoman twice. When Father Valley goes for the final blow, Clayface attacks. Father Valley shoves a grenade into Clayface and blows him apart. We see that Catwoman dives into the river, and when she thinks all hope is lost, we see Batman reaches a hand for her.
Things are definitely coming together plot-wise, Drew. Very excited to see. It feels like we're going to get something pretty climactic next issue. Obviously, I don't know for sure, but it definitely feels that way.
I got to tell you, I was happy to see Batman there. I'm very curious, after this event, the relationship starts back up. I'm very curious if they're going to start partnering together and stuff again.
I don't know. I mean, I think they might maybe for a bit, but it's interesting because I feel like DC sort of is trying to have their cake and eat it too, where they clearly don't want Batman and Catwoman to be officially married like Lois and Superman are. But they are also writing stories in the future where they definitely did get married. And so it's weird where they're like trying to do both, and just they seem to be content to just kind of leave it at that. So I'm not sure, so sure that they will, to be honest with you, Drew.
Well, I'm going to be hopeful and hope that they do. So,
oh, I agree. To be clear, I agree with you. I wish they would just – I feel like most people like that relationship. I'm sure not everyone does, but you can't please everyone. But that one seems like a pretty widely enjoyed relationship for the two. And I don't know, at a certain point, stop beating around the bush. Like, just commit to something. Like, imagine if DC never committed to Superman and Lois. Come on. Like all these other stories that they couldn't have told.
Yeah, I think it would be an interesting dynamic, you know, with Alfred being gone, bringing Catwoman on as his wife, and, you know, them being a team and them relying on each other. So I don't know, I just find it interesting. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League number 65. Black Canary is not happy that Oliver is involved with Checkmate. Damon Rose explains that he's Lois Lane's brother. He needs Checkmate's help. The van blows up, and then Deathstroke makes an appearance. Deathstroke states he's here for Damon Rose. Oliver and Dinah realize that Deathstroke is not Slade Wilson, and everyone fires at each other, and they're all taken out. Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice, Sinmar Utopica attacks. Batman tells Naomi to take her parents to the basement library. If any Justice League Dark members are sleeping down there, have them come up. And they come across John Constantine, who just finished using the restroom. Batman has the Wonder Twins activate their powers. Jan becomes Gorilla Grodd, and Zan becomes a bucket of water that gets thrown on Aquaman. The Batplane is on fire, and Batman calls in all Leaguers. Naomi distracts Sinmar long enough for Superman to grab him and take him into space. Then Superman goes down along with Hawkgirl, and Sinmar rams into the Hall of Justice.
This issue was entertaining, Drew. I feel like this has been fairly representative of what we get with Bendis, especially with his DC stuff. It just doesn't... There's not enough there to really judge it plot-wise as a story. It just barely gets started or barely continues. You know what I mean? Like, interesting stuff happens, and I was entertained as I was reading it, but also plot-wise, not a whole lot happens.
Though, when I read this, though, to me, it felt like there's been more stuff going on than in previous Bendis stories we've been reading.
I think it's just because he has other plot lines going, not necessarily because there's more. Like I said, I was entertained. The fight between Sinmar and the Justice League was entertaining. The confrontation between apparently fake Deathstroke, we learn, or at least somebody not Slade is posing as Deathstroke, and Green Arrow and Black Canary, that was interesting. Like, again, interesting, entertaining stuff, but also I wanted more, and not necessarily more like, oh, I can't believe, like, I need the next issue. It was like, I don't feel like I got quite a full issue's worth of story.
I can understand that. And it's funny how Bendis kind of like throws the Wonder Twins in there and stuff.
The bucket of water thing was super funny because like you're like, wait, what? That's because that in itself was a kind of a joke that that's, you know, the one Wonder Twin is always sort of comparatively useless. And then, you know, so just the joke of turning into the bucket of the water was funny enough. And then using it to basically splash Aquaman to power him up was hilarious.
It was funny. All right. And we also got the Justice League Dark story in this. Batman tells Elnara that the bad guys use some kind of spell to fragment the old man's mind and create multiple instances of his own imagination, like dreaming 100 dreams at once. Batman states the only way to free him is if Elnara goes into his mind. She'll have to destroy the prime archetypes within each dream. Destroy enough and the real him should get control back. If the real one dies, Elnora will be trapped in his mind forever. Inside his mind, Elnora fights her way to the tower where she finds Radnir Singh as a little boy. Radnir states that this is how he was able to preserve himself. In Atlantis, a monster known as an Amhulis is chewing into the shield. This creature was extinct over 30,000 years ago. Merlin is standing on the creature, happy that the Justice League Dark has shown up, and this is to be continued.
Another great issue. I don't know what else to add. Justice League Dark just continues to kill it. It's so good.
Yeah, and this one just focused on Batman and Elnora. So we didn't even see the other members of the Justice League Dark.
And that's the thing. I mean, and part of that, obviously, Justice League Dark is dealing with limited real estate as the backup issue, but that's, I feel like that despite the fact that it has less room to tell a story, and it is also doing essentially two different storylines, I feel like Ram V is doing a better job fitting his story into the limited space than Bendis is doing with a larger amount of time. I feel like more plot is still going into Justice League Dark.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. And, It does feel like we're getting more bang for our buck with the Justice League Dark story, for sure. It's a lot more focused. Of course, it has to be.
But it deserves credit. You're right. It does have to be, but it also deserves credit for executing that. To be clear, both stories are really entertaining. I just think, to me, it's pretty clear that Justice League Dark is executing on a higher level than the main story is.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Nightwing number 82. The issue opens up with Nightwing telling Oracle to call off the rescue. She's called in the Titans as well as Batman. Belinda Zucco takes Dick Grayson upstairs to meet her mother, Maylee Lynn. She tells Dick that she was 23 years old and paid for when she came to this country. Tony Zucco was violent and possessive, but she had no interest in being possessed. One night, she was taken to the circus and she escaped. John and Mary take care of Zucca while Maylee Lynn hides in John's trailer. Maylee ends up joining the circus, which was the best time of her life. It was before John and Mary were together, and John and Maylee weren't together for long, but long enough. Zucca finds Maylee when the circus was in Star City. Zucca took her, then gave John payback. John looked for Maylee, but Zucco took her from Star City to Bloodhaven, and then 6 months later, Melinda was born. The next time Maylee escaped was years later. Zucco didn't stop her. He'd already moved on. Maylee brought Melinda to the circus to meet John. When Maylee saw Dick and how happy the three were, she left. Maylee planned to come back one day. Before she found the courage, Zucco killed them. Dick asks Melinda if Maylee knows she's a criminal. Melinda states, "You don't know what I am." And then the issue ends with Blockbuster at Melinda's door with an army of armed police. Now, I found the story of Melinda's origin interesting, but what I did find confusing at the end was, you know, Dick saying, "Yeah, does she know you're a criminal?" And she goes, "I don't know what I am." And then Blockbuster surrounding the place. It's like, why the heck is Blockbuster there? The only thing I could think of is, did Melinda call them there, or is there something else going on? I don't know. I found it kind of confusing because it feels like they want us to think Melinda's a criminal, but is she?
Yeah, I have to agree. It felt like Blockbuster knew that Nightwing was there, but why? How? How would he know that he's there? There's no reason for him to know that. So it'd be interesting to see next issue why he's showing up. I found the backstory interesting for his half-sister and her mom. I do feel like, though, Drew, this is one of those things that happens in comics occasionally where you're introducing something that it's a new story, but you intertwine it so heavily in an already established backstory that you end up, in my opinion, you end up almost creating a problem for future writers to have to dance around. I mean, let's use Tom King, for example, a writer I really like. He did that with Heroes in Crisis, clearly created a huge problem for every other writer writing Wally since then, has had to dance around the outcome of Heroes in Crisis, right?
Right.
And DC has struggled mightily to kind of fix and work around that story. And not that this is on necessarily the same magnitude, but this is one of those things that now it's out there as a story, and this will always be part of his story now, which is possible. I'm not necessarily opposed to that, but, or people aren't going to want to really mess with that. And it does, to me, it feels a little weird to Dick's dad to have had another kid. You know what I mean? Like, that feels a little weird to me. I feel like that's I know that the writer did everything they could to basically be like, no, he's a good guy and he didn't know and blah, blah, blah. But like, it's like, it's a little weird. Are the writers going to have to write around this? Are they just going to have to ignore it and pretend it never happened? I don't necessarily think this is a bad thing. I'm just curious how this story will affect future stories that aren't by this author.
Yeah, I see the problem. And I got to tell you, it felt weird to me because I've known the Dick origin for a long time, and this did feel weird. I see what you're saying. People have to dance around it, or they might just totally ignore it. It just depends. It depends if Melinda's going to stick around or not. And she may only with this writer on the book, and then again, they may keep her around for some reason. It depends on where the story goes to, if people like it or not.
Yeah. And this has been a good Nightwing run. So I think there's a chance, you know, when a run is good, the stuff that happens in that title is more likely to stick. So I think there's a real chance that she sticks at least a little bit, obviously, depending on how the story plays out. But it'll be kind of interesting. I just found the backstory to be a little bit odd, only in that they established that ultimately Dick's parents were already working together, but they weren't yet in a relationship. But they sure acted like they were. And then they're like, oh, no, but actually they weren't yet, because that's what we need for the story. But then as soon as I'm out of the picture, then they got in a relationship. And all of that just felt, I don't know. I felt like that made it more weird.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Shazam number one. The Titans are battling Chemo when Shazam joins the fight. He loses his powers and is caught by Donna Troy. Billy explains to Nightwing that his powers randomly turn on and off. He can't control them. He can't share them with the others. He's afraid that at some point he might not be able to turn back into a boy. Billy goes to see Raven. He tells her about the vision he has at the Rock of Eternity exploding into flames and then gone. He doesn't know where the wizard is, and Mary and Freddy keep calling a lot, but Billy doesn't really feel like talking. Billy accidentally runs into Brick, and they get into an argument. Starfire pulls Billy aside and talks to him about being a better example. A LuxCom low Earth orbit satellite has failed. It's falling to Earth. Billy tries to change into Shazam, but it doesn't work at first. When he finally transforms, his powers fail, and he falls back to Earth, but is caught by Superboy John Kent. When Billy gets back to his room, Mary is there waiting for him. It's Freddy. He's been in the hospital since last Tuesday. Dr. Fate is consulting with the Titans. He tells them there is a massive celestial event, but it's not crisis level yet, and the Rock of Eternity is in hell. Both Dane and Miguel offer to help Billy on his journey to hell, and Dane has the ability to take them there personally.
There was nothing egregious, Drew, in this issue. I'm not sold.
I'm interested in finding out why Billy's powers aren't working. I'm sure it has to do with the Rock of Eternity being in hell. It's not just the Rock of Eternity that's being affected. We're seeing, like, the Olympians on Mount Olympus being under attack. Something tells me these events are all tied together.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I'm not too worried about this being as atrocious as the Future State title was, only because I think it would be hard to replicate that. One thing that's frustrating me, Drew, with not just this Shazam book, but we're seeing it in Green Lantern, and I feel like we've seen it recently with some of these other DC books, is it seems like the thing that the go-to for writers right now is, what's the new and different thing I could do with this character? Well, what if I took away their powers? I mean, yeah, sure, I guess that's new and different, but also, like, I like Shazam because I like his powers. I like what makes him Shazam. I'm not going to be like, oh, wow, all of the Shazam, but without any of the Shazam? Great. Sign me up for that book.
I know what you mean. But I do like the fact that they brought in Dr. Fate. There's definitely something bigger behind this story, and it's affecting more than one book. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And I agree with you. I don't think we're not going to get the story that we got in Future State, thank God, but I am curious to see what is going on. All right, let's move on to our last title for this week, The Flash number 772. The bills are piling up, so Linda asks Wally to get a job. Wally gets hired on at Speedy Lube. An old woman is not too happy when it takes him an hour to do an oil change. Michael Holt drives into Speedy Lube in a fancy red sports car. He's not here for an oil change. Michael owns the place. He fires Wally because he has a better opportunity for him, working at Terrific-Tech. At Terrific-Tech, Wally is a new engineer working with some other scientists, Marcy, Thomas, and Stevie. The location is one of several hubs placed strategically throughout the world. With a number of temporal incursions and Speed Force-related events in Central City, it's a perfect place for experiments. Michael explains he designed the campus himself with a state-of-the-art gym, yoga on Wednesday, and a private masseuse who makes the rounds on Fridays. The best part is free lunches for all employees, full health, dental, and a school stipend for the kids. Another perk of working for Mr. Terrific is Wally can cut out whenever he needs to. He can just tell the others he's on special assignment and with a secret entrance and exit for when he needs to disappear. We see there's a fire downtown at a hospital, and the fire truck ladders will not reach the top, so Wally rescues these people. Wally is about to put out the fire when he notices there's still one more person, and when Wally goes to that room, he's attacked from behind, and it's Heat Wave.
I definitely like the new status quo with Wally working for Mr. Terrific. I like that a lot. I personally enjoyed this one more now that we're kind of out of the time hopping thing. This felt like a more kind of getting into the flow of being the Flash, and I enjoyed that. So I'm excited to see where this plot goes.
I really like this issue too. Mr. Terrific being in it was awesome. Wally working for him, give him. You know, he's making the money he needs to make to support his family. Plus, he can go do superheroing stuff whenever he needs to. I really like that. And we have Michael Holt can be part of the Flash story anytime because he's working for him. That's cool, too. If we can pull in the Terrifics in some sort of Flash Terrific story, that'd be freaking awesome, too. I'd love that. I don't think it's going to happen, but I would love it. But I do like the new status quo, too, a lot. And I thought this was a really fun issue. All right, well, that wraps up our comics talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Geek here with a shout-out to all the scientists who worked tirelessly to bring a COVID-19 vaccine into reality. Let's face it, creating something of this magnitude is a miracle worthy of Dr. McCoy himself. And now, Dr. Geek needs you to do your part. Remember, each shot is one small step back to normal, one giant leap to putting the pandemic behind us. We can do this. For more information, visit vaccines.gov to find your nearest provider.
And we're back. Let's talk Superman and Lois, Season 1, Episode 13, Failsafe. Superman goes to Tal's prison cell and asks where Laura Lar is. Superman tells Tal that his father's crystals will never be used again, and Superman tells Tal that he'll never see him again. Mayor Dean of Smallville asks Hal Cushings to take a few weeks off of work because of the whole Morgan Edge business. The mayor says he has the Cushings' back. Later in the episode, Lana overhears the mayor bad-mouthing the Cushings, and Lana gives him a piece of her mind. John Henry is staying at the Kent farm in his RV. He plans to hang there until Laura Lar is found. Clark suggests he could talk to Sam about working for the DOD, but John Henry turns him down. When the Laura Lar business is done, John Henry plans on making this Earth his home. John Henry gets a signal from his Kryptonian detector. Laura Lar is heading for the DOD. Superman is able to intercept her before she reaches the DOD building, and John Henry takes her out with one of his Red Sun weapons. Jonathan and Tegan skip school together. Jonathan figures out the only reason she wants to be with Jonathan now is because she wants information on what happened with Edge. We also see Jordan and Sarah skip school together, and Sarah takes Jordan to this bridge where they talk and then kiss. A conservation officer comes along and breaks up the kissing. Superman visits Tal again, asking about the Eradicator device. Superman tells Tal that Laura Lar has been captured, and Tal tells Superman that they are the same. Superman tells Tal goodbye. Superman gives John Henry the responsibility to kill him if he ever gets out of control again. Lois apologizes to Chrissy and tells her she's too close to the story to be objective, so Lois gives Chrissy enough to write the story. Jonathan and Jordan are grounded for skipping school, and Tal becomes the Eradicator and breaks out of the DOD. He goes to the Yellow Sun and absorbs energy from it.
So that's definitely something we've been suspecting, I think, for at least the past one or two episodes, that he was going to actually become the Eradicator, which is pretty cool. I'm curious to see what that's going to look like, if they're going to alter his look at all. I'm not sure. Obviously, you know, the glow of his eyes changed, but it'd be kind of cool if he maybe looked a little bit like the Eradicator too. Not that he needs to, but that'd be cool.
Yeah, I think it would be cool if they stuck him in the Eradicator's costume, gave him those weird looking goggle things he wears. Yeah. But I don't know if they're going to do that.
It's cool that they're doing an Eradicator story, and I feel like this makes sense, especially for the CW. The way that they're doing this makes the most sense if you're going to try to do the Eradicator, to do it something like this.
Yeah, now all we need is Cyborg Superman to show up and Jordan to put on a Superboy costume. We got the return of the Superman storyline.
Honestly, I would think that they would probably want to bring Cyborg Superman on if they hadn't completely screwed the pooch on that one in Supergirl. I feel like that ship has sailed now on them.
I could see them bringing in a different Cyborg Superman and ignoring the other story.
I would like it. But, I mean, they just bombed so hard on that character. Part of me wonders if they just don't want to touch that character again.
That could very well be possible. But, this was a... I was wondering where they were going to go after, you know, the last episode felt like a season finale. And it was interesting that they just kind of continued the story here. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with the Eradicator. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. The Flash, Season 7, Episode 18, Heart of the Matter, Part 2. When the episode opens, Nora has lost faith as she fears for her brother's life. Joe and Kramer scramble out of the car as two Godspeed clones battle. Joe exclaims, "God help us." Flash is in August's mind. August gives us his origin. He was a young physicist who wanted to run faster than light, so he created the velocity formula. But it wasn't enough, because no matter how fast he ran, he realized one fact. It was not fast enough. Next, August brings up Impulse. Impulse made August realize that artificial speed would never compare to natural speed. August tells Barry that Bart is a spoiled brat who is reckless and unworthy of the gift he's been given. August fractured himself in time. It's what created his memory loss. August tells Barry that he will reabsorb the clones if Barry gives him natural speed. If Barry refuses his request, the Flash's city will burn. Big Nora, the Speed Force, shows up and gives everyone a boost of speed, including Impulse, who wakes from his coma. When a Godspeed clone tries to attack Joe with his vibrating hand, Kramer saves him using her super speed. She has white lightning, and when Joe tells her what happened, she passes out. Dozens of Godspeed clones are fighting when Bart shows up. They all stop and say in unison, "Kill the adversary." The rest of the Team Flash shows up and it's battle time, and everybody has a cool move. Bart tosses lightning in shape of Chinese throwing stars. Nora uses a lightning whip. Big Nora snaps her fingers and the Godspeed clones are zapped. Jay imbues his helmet with lightning and throws it at the Godspeed clones, knocking him down like a pinball machine. We see Barry tosses lightning, and Iris uses speed wind. The Godspeed clones recharge off the Speed Force, draining the Flashes of their power. Allegra shows up and uses Chester's gizmo to send out a wave of energy that knocks out the Godspeed clones unconscious. More Godspeed clones show up, and Sisko creates a temporary shield for him and Frost until they leave. Barry and Iris try to give August natural Speed Force powers. Once Barry gives him juice, August goes bad. He calls back all his clones, and then Godspeed tells Flash he'll die by his hand. Godspeed and Flash fight. When Godspeed gets the upper hand, Reverse Flash comes to the rescue. Godspeed makes a lightning sword, so Flash and Reverse Flash follow suit. We have a big old lightsaber battle, till finally Thawne runs his lightning sword through August's gut. Next, Thawne wants to battle Barry, but Barry is much faster than Thawne. Barry tosses Thawne like a doll. August's heart is in Iron Heights, and Big Nora was able to remove August's memory of Barry's secret identity. Kramer can mimic the ability of any meta in close proximity. She's taken an indefinite leave of absence from the CCPD. Barry and Iris renew their vows. Bart sings them a song. Sisko presides over the ceremony. And then Barry and Iris kiss in Flash time. For one thing I gotta say, I love the season finale, but it had a lot of freaking ridiculous stuff in it.
Oh my God. Part of me wonders, Drew, I don't know if target audience is the right word in this case, but like, this show feels like it's more for people who just want moments and don't necessarily care whether the overall plot makes sense. Because like, the lightsaber fight is cool. It's also really stupid. Like, that was so dumb. Where did that come from? It's cool, I'm not gonna lie. It looks cool, and it's an awesome idea as an action scene, but it's dumb. And then, like, the wedding scene, why did they even do that? I don't know. But again, if you only care about moments, you know, you're like, oh, Yoss, Flash and Iris getting married, sweet. Does that make sense as the conclusion to the season? No. Where did that come from? And then Bart singing, again. What? How did we dedicate 5 minutes to him singing, Drew? He's been on the show for 2 episodes. I don't care about that character enough to watch him sing for 5 minutes. But again, if you don't care about how the plot works or how the show works as a whole, and you just want cool moments that you can put out on Twitter, these are great, right? These are all like great Twitter moments that you can put out there. But as a plot, as an episode, what are we doing?
Exactly. I guess you put it when you said it was moments, you put it together very well. We got a lot of moments in this that I thought were cool. One of my favorites is the Jay Garrick scene where he imbues his helmet with energy and then throws it and knocks out all the clones. I love that scene. But I also thought the lightning lightsaber battle was kind of cool, but it was stupid. It was stupid. Yeah.
I mean, that's the best way to describe it. I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's not cool, because it is. I mean, lightsabers are cool. I'm not going to hate that, but it is objectively stupid. It makes no sense for them to be doing that. It's awesome Reverse Flash shows up, but that was so... I mean, why did he show up? I know they sort of like, he didn't want August to kill him, so he shows up to help, but like, okay, you know what I mean? Like, it was a very flimsy, weak excuse that was basically just, well, the cool thing to do is to have Reverse Flash show up and join in on the lightsaber fight, so that's what we did. Again, does it make sense plot-wise? No, but it's the cool thing to do.
And it got Wells back in the season finale.
Right, and then... And to be fair, Flash is regularly guilty of this, where Barry can't do anything all season. He routinely gets beaten, barely gets by these villains, and then right at the end of the season, when it's the finale, all of a sudden he's the Capital Flash again, and he just whoops Reverse Flash in 2 seconds, right? That's cool. Again, that's a really cool thing to do, but if he could do that, why isn't he doing that against Godspeed? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then the other thing, that we had the ridiculous power-up of the Speed Force coming in and powering everybody up. Even Bart. I mean, if Bart... She could have just came in and fixed Bart right away instead of him lying there forever.
I mean, that was the thing. I mean, they just sort of convenienced everything away. It's crazy to me, given this show's history of having a problem of stretching plots too thin, that this is the exact opposite, where everything was so rushed. I did not feel bad, or I felt nothing when good August sort of gets taken over by the real August. I was like, okay, we barely even saw him. That doesn't mean anything to me. Ugh. I don't know. It's interesting to me because I felt like this episode, I felt like I understood the show better, just as what the writers are trying to do, which is I don't know that they really care if the plot makes sense. They're just like, what's the cool moment that we could have? And everything is sort of like a loose, really flimsy attempt to tie stuff together. But I feel like from their perspective, and I could be wrong, but this is just the impression that I'm getting, is they don't really care. Is that they just want these cool moments every episode, and that's if they get that, that's all that matters. It doesn't matter if the connective tissue in between those makes no sense.
Yeah. You pointing that out and looking back at the season, it makes perfect sense, all the moments we've seen, especially the ones we pointed out that were great for commercials.
That's exactly it. I think it's just a collection of, like I said, just little clips that work really well. Like, you can put those clips out in commercials, you can put those clips out on social media, but also those are the clips, those are the moments that people are going to put on, they're going to talk about those moments on social media. They're not going to talk about the 5 minutes in between those that didn't really do anything. Nobody's going to talk about that, so they don't care. They're just like, it feels like they're just like going for whatever is going to get the most buzz, and it doesn't really matter if the show is actually working.
I think we can say that the theme of this season is Barry doesn't need big fists because he's got a big heart.
I'm very excited to see next season. I'm assuming she's staying as the police chief. I'm not sure. That seemed a little unclear. But my God, Drew, can you imagine what they're going to do with her? That is the most plot convenient power of all time. She can basically just summon whatever power she needs in the moment. Phenomenal.
Oh, I could totally see. I could totally see them using her as part of Team Flash.
Oh yeah, and they're gonna, you know, but then they're gonna like conveniently not use her, even though there's no situation in which she wouldn't be the answer. She literally is the answer for any problem with that power. I mean, there should be no crime left in Central City because she could just manifest whatever power is necessary at any moment. What a magical power, Drew.
I know, it's great, isn't it? Yeah, it will be interesting to see what they do next season. The feeling, I didn't think they'd be putting her back as in charge. I figured Joe would take that spot back over since she was going to be gone indefinitely. And I figured she'd just show up when they conveniently needed her for stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that wouldn't surprise me.
And I don't think Flash is going to be back until next November. So we're going to get quite a break from it. Some of the other shows come back before the Flash does. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. DC's Legends Tomorrow, Season 6, Episode 10, Bad Blood. John Constantine calls in Crawley's banker, Noelle, which happens to be a vampire. She reluctantly gives John the map to the Fountain of Imperium and a potion. On the Wave Rider, the Legends try to get the alien baby to sleep with a lullaby. Sarah and Ava are off looking for a wedding venue, and Gary's lost his glasses. Mick's egg sack on the back of his neck gets bigger. John recruits Spooner to help him decipher the map to the Fountain of Imperium. The fountain was last seen in Albacete, Spain in 1939. At this time, Spain has spent the last 3 years in a civil war. It's a class war. On one side, the rich and the military backed by the Nazi Germany, and on the other side, the trade unions and the democratically elected government of Spain. John and Spooner start their search for a man named El Gato, who apparently survived numerous assassination attempts. Constantine and Spooner walk into a bar. They find El Gato and learn that his nephew is the one with magical powers. Fascists show up, and John and El Gato fight back. Constantine, Spooner, and Fernando escape the tavern and go to a cave that contains the Fountain of Imperium. At the cave, Spooner tries to move Fernando's magic into John, but it doesn't work. John uses Crowley's potion to defeat Noriega and his men, and then at the end of the episode, Constantine trades Crowley's painting to Noelle for more of the potion. I'm wondering if Constantine is going to get his magic powers back this season. Something tells me he's not.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be, if he doesn't, or if he gets it back right at the end. I wonder, just based on what we know for what Matt Ryan is doing next season, if he's getting written off the show at the end of the year. The Constantine character specifically. Obviously not Matt Ryan. I'll be kind of curious to see what they do. I feel like he will get his powers back. I feel like if they do write him off into the sunset, it'll be with his powers. I can't imagine them just retiring a powerless Constantine, because that just doesn't make sense for the character.
No, but we do know he's going to be taking these potions to use magic for quite a while, probably most of the rest of the season.
Yeah. You know what I like? Sometimes poor character decisions kind of drive me nuts for certain characters, because you feel like they ought to be better than that, and they're not, just for the sake of the plot. One of the things I really liked throughout this episode, obviously his use of the potion, but just also, you know, not always necessarily doing exactly the right thing, felt very in line with who Constantine is. You know, that sort of, ultimately he does the right thing in the episode, right? He helps the rebels out, he helps the boy out, but he does it in a very morally questionable way throughout the whole episode, and that just felt very John Constantine. I thought the episode nailed that really well.
The other thing, it felt like John has an addiction to magic. That's what it felt like to me. It was almost an addiction, and he was going through withdrawal with not having his magic. And it's just getting worse.
Yeah, I agree completely.
So, but I liked how this episode mostly focused on John's story, and it stayed focused on John's story, even though we had some of the other little bits going on. The story did a good job of focusing on John's story, mostly, instead of spreading stuff out more.
I thought this was a pretty good episode, and I agree, I think, in part because it was so focused on the Spanish story, which was good. I felt this was one of the better uses of time travel they've done recently. Not that they haven't done good time travel stories, but this was a really good period piece that I thought they did. This was good stuff.
I agree. All right, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Sweet Tooth, Season 1, Episode 3, Weird Deer Sh**. Gus and Big Man make a pit stop where Big Man has a hidden stash. The plan is to take a train to Colorado. Big Man makes Gus a disguise to hide the fact that he's a hybrid. The doctor has taken over the practice. He's been making the medicine without the hybrids, but it's not working. The doctor and his wife go to a party, and they have to hide the fact that she is sick. During the party, we see that the host drops a wine glass, and he starts getting the twitchy pinky. The doc does a test, and it's positive. Their host has the virus, and they wrap him in plastic wrap and then burn his house down with him inside. That's like, dang, that's freaking dark.
Yeah.
While Big Man is getting a train ticket, Gus wanders off and runs into a girl. Gus is about to get on the train when he smells Big Man's candy. Big Man takes him to find the meds. They almost get caught, but Big Man takes out the men. Gus is about to get on the train when a man with a gun yells, "Hybrid!" And Big Man and Gus are captured, and the train leaves without Gus. When they are being taken into the woods, Gus and Big Man are rescued by the girl Gus met in the market. And then at the end of the episode, a bad man tells the general they found the girl.
I mean, I don't know what else to say other than just what a great episode yet again. I'm just so into this show, Drew, and it just sucks me in every time. It's hard to, especially because it's on Netflix, it's hard to just watch this one episode at a time.
I know it is. And I'm really enjoying the series, too. One of the things I like about it, not only is it well done, it gives us a break from superhero stuff to focus on something different.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I am very curious. I think that this, I like all of the story, to be clear, but the thing that the plot line that has me the most hooked is the doctor. And I'm so curious if is that set concurrently to Sweet Tooth's story, or is, I still feel like that's happening prior to the main plot. I don't know. And I'm so intrigued by, like, you know what I mean, like where that's taking place exactly chronologically. And that also that looming sense of dread, like, you know, that he's probably going down a dark path, and it feels like towards that.
Yeah, it sure does. I found that story intriguing too, this episode, especially it was dark to burn down that dude's house with him inside. It felt kind of cruel. You would think they find a more humane way of getting rid of the dude besides burning him alive in his house. I understand they're trying to destroy the virus and stuff, but man, that's cruel.
I mean, I agree, but I also feel like that better fits the world that they're in, that is sort of chaos, right? Like, it's sort of lost a lot of the rules of civilization, which is, I think, part of how we've gotten to where we are in the story. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think there is a more humane method, but also that it's not where civilization is at in this story.
No, it's not. The other thing I'm curious about, we know Big Man's taking this medicine, and I'm assuming it's life-threatening if he doesn't get this medicine. They haven't told us what it is or why he needs it, but that's basically one of the reasons we see him keeping Gus around, because Gus could smell his medicine. So, you know, kind of a need for him. We see that they, of course, try to part ways again, and it just doesn't work out.
There's so many things. I think one of the things this show is doing so well is there are just so many things that you want to know, you know, find out and know the answer to. You know, what's the story with these kids? What's the story with, you know, Big Man's medicine? Sweet Tooth's mom? What's going on with the doctor? Like, all of it. There's so many good intriguing things going on, and the show just kind of hooks you in.
It sure does. All right, well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, I've shout out this comic, I think, a number of times, but just reading Grant Morrison's Superman book this week just makes me think of it again. But All-Star Superman is just, that's why I like Morrison writing Superman, because in my mind, that's the best Superman story anybody's written. And that's obviously subjective. I'm sure other people have favorites, but for me, that's peak Superman. That's the best, you know, everything encompassing what I want in a Superman story is All-Star Superman. So I'm thrilled to be seeing Grant writing him again. It felt very similar characterization to what you get in All-Star. So if you enjoyed that, if you've never read All-Star Superman, you've got to check it out. If you like Superman stories, or maybe you feel like he doesn't really do it for you normally because you think that the powers kind of make it a little boring, I recommend checking that out, because I feel like Grant just gets it right.
I agree. That's a really good story. All right. And for my shout out, I saw the movie Twister on the big screen today. Love that movie.
That's old school.
Yeah, it is. But I love that movie. Well, that's the movie theater I go to shows older movies. So, and I cannot remember if I'd seen that on the big screen before.
So, I remember when that came out, I was a kid. I remember that being like the big blockbuster one summer. I don't remember if it did well or not. Obviously, I'm too young to remember like box office stuff, but I remember that being one of the big blockbusters.
So I honestly can't remember if I've seen it in the theater before. Probably had, but I love that movie. My wife and I watch it. We probably watch it at least once a year, if not twice a year. So it was cool to go see it on the big screen. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman Secret Files Huntress number 1, Batman Superman, Checkmate, The Other History of the DC Universe, Wonder Woman Black and Gold, Strange Adventures, Action Comics, Detective Comics, Robin, Superman, Son of Kal-El, Teen Titans Academy, Wonder Woman, and Infinite Frontier. Oh, and of course, the only show we have going on right now is Sweet Tooth. So, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.